Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, maybe you've bought produce or fresh eggs from him at his roadside stand in Fresno. Bet you never knew this 93-year-old was a decorated pilot who survived being shot down by the Japanese.
About the time for me to just give up and quit that I saw a speck in the sky.
It's an incredible story told in emotional detail, and you'll hear it today at 1 on News Talk 580 1059, brought to you by Morrison's RV Parts and Service at 180 and Academy in Sanger.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women with stories that you wouldn't believe, the things that they did for the sake of our freedom. So we want to honor them, honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, we're entertained for sure, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to meet today, I've been hearing about for years. I've seen his name on the wall at the Veterans Memorial Museum in Fresno. He's the recipient of a Distinguished Flying Cross and the bearer of a really incredible story. Augie Palercio, 93 years old, originally from Fresno. Growing up out here in the country, west of Fresno, what was it like before World War II? What do you remember about your childhood?
Oh, like most kids, just grew up in trouble, not a trouble. But, yeah. My father was a laborer, primarily in concrete work, and he was making us do it also. We learned real early in life there's other trades to make a living a lot easier being a concrete worker, so I got into the machinist end of it. So as a profession, I was a machinist, engine building primarily, and I've done that for most of my life. Until I come along, I spent the 6 years in the Marine Corps. When we came back, I opened up my own parts store and a machine shop and just went on from there. The war come along, and I had two brothers that three sisters. My mother died when I was pretty young. And my father, he tried a number of wives, I think they were wives, and then he got fed up with it and he went back to Italy. And that left me with supporting two brothers and three sisters. And the war come along, and I decided I could do better in the service than as the way I was going to try to support these people. I was gonna end up in jail. I was just a kid. Tried to enlist in the Marine Aviation or the Navy, Naval Aviator, but they wouldn't take me because I didn't have 2 years of college. So I went into the Marines, and I was assigned to the 1st Marine Division. That's where I spent most of my time until we got down the Guadalcanal. On the initial landing, I was not in the first wave. I was in the third wave that hit the beach. After that, it was the Bloody Hill, Bloody Knoll, as we referred to it as. It was not too high a mountain, and whoever controlled that mountaintop controlled the beach. And it was a job trying to take it away from the Japanese. A bloody job. That's why the Knoll ended up known as the Bloody Knoll. Then the 1st Marine Air Wing moved in on Guadalcanal, and right away they were short of gunners. And I happened to be a machine gunner in the 1st Division, so I transferred from the 1st Marine Division to the 1st Marine Air Wing as a gunner in the back seat. I volunteered for that because I wanted to get into the aviation end of it because I was already a pilot.
You had become a pilot here before you joined the Marines?
I was a pilot before I joined the Marines, yes. when I was a kid, I used to ride my bicycle to Fresno Chandler. Always got into trouble with my father, but that's kids' days. I got a part-time call of the job cleaning airplanes, and we ended up trading it out for some airplane rides. And his name was Mr. Snyder. And he had a son about my age, but we weren't friends. I didn't even know him or anything until we got into high school. That's where we became pretty good buddies.
What kind of planes did you fly here before the war?
Piper Cub and the Tiger. Yeah. The Tiger was a little low-wing airplane, which I liked very well.
So you were a pilot, but because you didn't have the 2 years of college, they wouldn't take you. So, and you mentioned being a machine gunner on Guadalcanal. What kind of things did you experience? I imagine if you're a machine gunner, that makes you a pretty significant target for the enemy.
Well, as a machine gunner on the canal, it wasn't too much on the airplanes because it was mostly all groundwork. How many Japanese people I killed, I have no idea, but I do know that we started out with 62 men in my squad. And at the end of the third trip up that bloody knoll, as we started up, I counted how many men we had left. We had 15 left out of 62. While the Guadalcanal was going on, I qualified. It goes back to the boot camp days. I happened to be able to shoot both left-handed and right-handed. And so right away, that's why they made me a machine gunner, because I could shoot both sides of a tree or both sides of a rock. That's when they said, called me in one day and said, "We're sending you back to the States." And I spouted off, "No, you're not." That took a lot of nerve, but I was a nervy kid those days. To make a long one short, I ended up going to naval flight training, but I wouldn't give up my regular status in the Marine Corps because I planned to make that my career, and I didn't want to be a reserve. So we went through there. It was more or less my flight training just lasted about maybe 3 weeks, stretch it to 4 weeks, and I was back on the canal, this time as a pilot flying SBDs. And as the days went on, the flights were coming along, it seemed like the Japs would never run out of ships, no matter how many we sank. But one time it cost me. As a pilot, we went out on a strike. The Japs were sending a fleet of ships up the slot to either resupply their troops or to take them off. And of course, I had a gunner in the back seat. And you know, that poor boy was, I don't think he was 17 years old. He lied more than I did. But anyway, evidently he stopped in any aircraft shell with his chest. And of course, it blew the plane out of control, so we landed it in the water. As I was trying to get him out of the cockpit, back the back seat, he had his gunner's belt on. And I don't know if you know what a gunner's belt is, but it's like a garter belt that girls wear to hold their stockings up, I think. But and I had trouble trying to get him out, and while I was doing that, I could see his chest was wide open. It was all, he was dead, shot dead center. The shell must have went off right in back of him. Of course, he was facing the rear. And so we got in the water. I tried to get him out. And the plane was going down, I think about 10 feet, I run out of air. I come up for air and I went back down. I couldn't find it, I lost it. So I lost him, and I spent, they tell me, about 4 hours. The last couple of hours probably, I wasn't all myself. It's hard to find anybody or anything that's down in the water with the white caps. They all look the same, no matter what you do. I was about ready to give up. I'd been in there for I don't know how long, 2 hours, 3 hours. I don't know whether, and so help me, this is the truth. I was wearing my way west, but like everything else, I guess, the more you think about it, the more you think the May West is going south. That means the air is coming out of it. So I decided to make ones out of my pants. They taught us in training how to take your pants off and tie the legs together and then shake it in the air and slam it in the water. And that traps a bunch of air in there, and that's another life jacket. Well, like a dumb kid, I had it all ready to slap it in the air, and I thought, by golly, if some shark comes along and sees that little worm there, I'd be a goner. So I put my pants back on. And about the time for me to just give up and quit, because I couldn't see any use, then I saw a speck in the sky. It was a PBY Navy patrol plane. And evidently, not the pilot, some of the mechanics inside the airplanes spotted me, and they told the pilot about it, and so he started to circle me, but I could tell he wasn't seeing me because he wasn't passing any signals on to me or anybody. Finally, he evidently saw me, and so to acknowledge the fact that he saw me, he rocked his wings real hard. Sure enough, he got in the wind. He landed in. That's some of the stuff they told me after I come to. He landed into the wind, but I do remember two sailors diving overboard. Even before PBY ever stopped, and pretty soon something was grabbing me, and somebody said, "Roll over on your back." What back? So he did something else. He got me turned over, and one guy grabbed me on my, I didn't have much hair, so they couldn't grab my hair, so he grabbed my May West, I think, they started to pull it, but it started to come off of my shoulders. Then he grabbed something else, and these two guys got me to the ship. And when I got on the pontoon, they laid me down there, and I thought they were beating the hell out of me. But they were pounding on me, but they were trying to get the water out of me, so that was okay. And they finally were satisfied, so we got inside, and after about maybe 10, 20 cups of coffee, I got into some dry clothes, and they put a Navy blanket on me, and first thing you know, they thought I died. But then they told me, no, we found out you were just went to sleep. And I must have slept for 2 days. But when I woke up, I was hungry. I've never been that hungry again. Never. That salt water didn't do any good for my appetite either. So we finally got back to the beach. And when it unloaded me by then, I was back on my feet, and I went back to the squadron, back to flying, which is all right. You take your chances as they come. And life went on until I don't know how many flights. Altogether, I flew 146 missions in an airplane. And those missions, as they did them in those days, they didn't count for anything. They were just doing duty. Anytime you come back all shot up, then that counted for one. And of the 146, I came back 42 times shot all to pieces. And you know, you don't get to thinking about it till it's nothing you can do about it. Of all those pieces of lead, they were all within 15, maybe 20 feet from me.
Wow, that gets your attention. That gets all of our attention. And there's so much more to explore in the remarkable story of Augie Palacio, 93 years old. I'm pretty sure you could hear some of that emotion in his voice. And you might not be surprised to hear that tears were streaming down his face at times there. If you'd like to see some photos of Augie and even a video of him showing you what he was wearing that day he was shot down, just punch in Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook and you'll find it. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 93-year-old Augie Palacio of Fresno, California. In fact, if you find yourself on North Garfield Avenue, just west of Freeway 99 in Fresno, you might happen upon his produce stand, where he sells vegetables and fresh eggs on the honor system. If he's not there, you just leave your money in the box. He'll take your word for it. If he is there, he might even sell you one of his hundreds of chickens. But it's pretty amazing that he ever made it back from World War II, especially considering the story he was telling when we left off. No doubt we've cruised along through some pretty incredible things. It was really rare for an enlisted man to become a naval pilot, and for Augie to go from a machine gunner on the ground battling the Japanese with the 1st Marine Division on Guadalcanal to an aerial gunner with the 1st Marine Air Wing to a pilot of an SBD dive bomber, and he wasn't even done yet. But that was all a rare and incredible accomplishment. And he was telling us about the day in November of 1943 when the SBD he was flying for Marine Scout Bomber Squadron 144 was shot down, killing the rear-facing gunner in the back seat, a teenager from Oklahoma named Harold Riddle. This is in the Solomon Islands. You guys had been dive-bombing Bougainville. And where was it that you went down?
Oh, the location that was in between Munda Airfield and off to the right across the bay. It was in that bay right there where I went down in, right off the end of the airstrip. I couldn't get it back to the strip. I was trying to make the strip again. Right. I didn't have much control, but I did have a little bit. And that's where, when I hit the water in that SBD now, I hit pretty hard because I didn't have much control. And while I was trying to get the gunner out, I had my left leg jammed in there some way. And after all the pulling and pushing I could do and the cussing I could do, I finally got the leg out, but the water was in the cockpit by then. And, of course, the airplane kept going down as the I finally got up on the wing and was trying to get the gunner out. But if I could have, I couldn't have saved him anyway.
Did you think you were going to die right there?
Did I think I was going to die? Sure, I gave up. When I was in the water waiting, that's why I didn't see the two divers diving over the side. They told me that, and I know two things grabbed a hold of me, because one was up around my neck and one was down my belt, where my belt normally would be.
I'm just trying to imagine what that felt like for you, because you're a young man, you're halfway around the world from your family, you just lost this teenager who was in your gunner seat, and now you're about to die. What kinds of things were you thinking about? What was going through your mind?
Well, as I started to say a little while ago, I had two brothers and three sisters, and I didn't want the brothers getting in the war. And I did what I had to do. But then Pete he had lung problems, so he was 4F, and Mikey served in China.
You described some pretty amazing circumstances that you survived, that it's pretty incredible that you survived, and you even said you it's hard for you to believe yourself. Do you feel like somebody or someone was protecting you, that there was some kind of divine intervention there?
I've always felt somebody was protecting me. Somebody had to be protecting me. Who else could have helped me when I was practically dead in the water after, say, three and a half hours of treading water? Who made that man up in that PBY see me? It's impossible, because you have these white caps, and you're making white caps. For some reason or other, he must have had his eye just spotted long enough on me that, and once he saw me, you don't take your eye off of me. You can't. All you do is yell to your partner and try to get him to see the same thing. That's the same as in flying. When a Japanese plane is up above you, up in the sky, in the sun probably, you can't see him. Pretty soon you see a shadow. And you may see him, but your wingman won't see him. And sometimes he sees him and you don't.
Well, I hear you. Needle in a haystack, I guess, would be an apt analogy. And I think I've heard flea on an elephant from a sailor or two. It really is remarkable that everything happened just the way it did for you to survive that. And I know that that's just the tip of the iceberg. I'm sure you had to recover from that for a little while, but what happened next?
One of the first things I did after I got back on my feet was put in for a transfer to fighters. The CO didn't want me to do that. He said, "You're too good a dive bomber." "No, I'm not. I, if you want me to stay as a dive bomber, I want you to take that gunner out of there. I'll go by myself. I don't want the death of another man on my shoulders. Because I'm supposed to protect that poor kid. He couldn't have been more than 17. To him, I was an old man already." He said, "You can't do that. You have to use a gunner, that it will just ground you." I said, "Well, give me the gunner. I don't want to get grounded." So anyway, as life went along, the fighters come into Guadalcanal, and they were operating off of the canal. And pretty soon, they were short of pilots. Boy, that was the answer to my dreams. The CO didn't want me to go. He wanted me to stay where I was in a dive bomber. No, I'm going to be a fighter. So anyway, he just about had to okay my transfer, so I got into the fighters. Life went on. We're flying sometimes 2-3 times a day, because most people don't know this. We were beat. We were beat to death before we ever got started. Why we're not eating Japanese rice for breakfast? It's because a bunch of kids. That's all we were. Not very smart. Well, the fighter life went along just fine. Sub patrols were simple. I got paired up with a wingman, McMasters. His picture's right up over there, and he's supposed to be my wingman. You never flew by yourself. He always had a wingman. And his primary job was to keep the Japs off of my tail while I was trying to run in on the target. The fighters always went in first. Their primary job was to stop the small arms fire. And sometimes it was thick. One night we were sitting in the ready room, and the weather was bad. It was awful, awful. That Liberty ship that they converted to a carrier was rocking 2 and 3 ways all at the same time. The word come around over the PA system that they need a flight of 4 pilots to go out on a submarine hunt. Well, there happened to be 4 enlisted pilots in that squadron. I was one of them. They tell me I was the first one that jumped up and volunteered for it, and then the other 3 saw it, and we went out. And that Olson was mad. It was bad, awfully, awfully bad. On a carrier, you usually land up and you have a landing signal officer, the LSO. So you come up to the takeoff slot and he's standing there listening to your engine and looking at the atmosphere around you. And all the while he's there, he's giving you this signal. That means your engine's not putting out. He wants more. I was one of those guys that always liked to keep an ace in the hole, so I'd always try to cheat. Keep a little bit for myself. I never could. And pretty soon, he gave up this year and gave me the go. While he was doing this, you're not looking anything. So as he went down with his hand, that meant for me to go. I glanced over to the left wing, and there was four sailors there trying to hold that airplane down. Then I finally looked up to the end of the under the flight deck. And there was 20 feet of water above that deck. I thought, Augie, this is it. You'll never make it. So nothing to do but go. I had the power on. But by the time I went that 400 feet, the ship had come up and the water had gone down and I made it. I get up in the air and look and see how my wingman's doing, how Mac was doing. And he was having the same problems. Evidently, he took out off and he made it. But that was one time I was sure I was all gone. There's no way that airplane was flying through that wall of water. But that LSO knew his job. And I was airborne just as I hit that end of that deck. I got the flaps up, gear up, everything up. Power was all the way on, so I didn't have to do anything with that. But we got joined up. We finally got the other three. Mac got off okay. And he and I, we had to circle the carrier a couple of times before number three man come up. And then another three or four times, then the fourth man came up. And so we went out looking for this submarine that's supposed to be, and it was too close to the carrier. That's why they sent us out. It was a wild night. Pretty soon I thought I saw it. I said, I signaled to Mac, I said, I've got it, get in line. Come to find out it wasn't. It was just a dark spot on the ocean. Got back in formation. We were still looking for that submarine. Pretty soon Mac's signals, rocked his wings, got my attention, and he signaled that he saw it. So I went like this. That meant take over. So he took over and got there, and sure enough, there that thing, that submarine was on deck, not moving too fast. He must have been in trouble. So we reformed ourselves. I was leading it. Mac was number two. And I said, I signaled to Mac that I'm going in first. You bring the flight in if I make it. I made it. But all 650s were going full blast. And it was just a very little small arms fire. There was one anti-aircraft gun going, but I got it silenced pretty fast. And I finally dropped my depth charge. And of course, you never know whether you hit or miss. Or if you're missing a mile, you know you did. When they come back, we were talking among ourselves. You got a hit, Augie. You got a hit. You got a good hit. Of course, the air around that sub lighted up with the fire that was burning. So the other three guys, Mac and the other section, two more planes, they made runs on it, dropping their depth charges. And by then we were out of fuel, so we had to find that carrier. We finally found it, and as soon as we parked the airplanes, when we got out, we all ran up to the officer's deck, the OD, and we begged him to let us go out again. He wouldn't do it. no way, that carrier, that sub's gonna go down, you guys don't have to go back. And of course we tried to convince him that we should, and we had no problems, we could find it, give us a torpedo instead of anything else, and we'll, he wouldn't do it. So anyway, from what I understand, that submarine did go down. After that, the life just went along kind of dull, patrolling for those days, and just to kill them or get killed. The everyday ones, you don't even pay much attention to them. You live it, you get paid, you live it, and that's it. But this time it was Teague. So Teague and I were out, supposed to be flying test hops. I was supposed to be the test pilot, but I had two airplanes to test, so Teague was my buddy, and so I let him take the other one. And we go out, and sure enough, we're about 100 miles away from the carrier, a good 100 miles. And I spotted the flight a little bit below us. We were playing around about 11,000 feet. And this flight of six bombers, Japanese Bettys, were cruising along, and they had a flight of seven fighters with them. So I signaled to Teague, I said, we're going to attack. That meant, it told, gave him two messages. One was we're going to attack. The second one was that he's supposed to go on his own. He's supposed to forget about me. He's supposed to go on his own. And of course, if you wanted to reject the call, you signaled like that. And that's what he was doing. No, when we got back, Augie, you were crazy. Those airplanes were seven or eight, just the two of us. We're better pilots than thought of it. So we made our first run. Of course, he was moved off to the side because he picked his target, and I had mine. I had the Betty lined up for me. So I wanted all the speed I could get. So we flew just about where we were on top of them. Those pilots were asleep. They didn't even know we were in the sky. So when I got into the position that I wanted, all I had to do was roll over on my back, pull the nose down, and I was going straight down, picking up all the speed I could get a hold of. And I hit that Betty like shooting a dove. All 650s were going full blast.
Talk about an intense situation. I think the rest of us here are grabbing the edge of our seats. We can feel it too. And that's not the end of that encounter, but we do need to take a break. So we'll jump right back in midair in Augie Palacios' Corsair in the Pacific during World War II when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and I guess I should break it to you right now. There are just so many incredible elements to Augie Palacios' World War II story that I think, in fairness, we're going to have to continue this conversation with him next week. It's hard to believe he's 93 years old, and I'm glad we finally have him here on Hometown Heroes. Tell you a little of the background. One of my favorite places in Fresno is the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor. And in the foyer there, you'll find giant replicas of prestigious medals with engraved lists of names underneath them representing local servicemen and women who've received those medals. In fact, you'll find my grandfather's name on the Silver Star and the Bronze Star. But on the Distinguished Flying Cross list, you'll find our guest today. And one of the docents at the museum, Les Traeger, has long been telling me how remarkable Augie's story was, from enlisted man fighting on Guadalcanal with the Marines to aerial gunner to fighter pilot. Not too many made that journey. I'm glad we finally have Augie on the program, and not too many of us would know what it feels like to be diving on a Japanese bomber firing a steady stream of lead from all six 50 caliber machine guns on an F4U-4B Corsair. That's where we left Augie before the break, and you said you shot that bomber like you were shooting a dove, but then what?
So I went to pull out, and my Corsair didn't want to come out of it. In those days, we didn't know it. When you come close to the sound barrier, you don't have much control of that Corsair because all it wanted to do was porpoise on its own. And you tried to catch it as it was porpoising up, you pull back for all you're worth on the stick to get keep the nose up there. I thought I was a goner again, but pretty soon it started to come out. And one of the things you always have to do, much as you don't want to, you pull the throttle off so you can slow down. It responded. So by the time I got back into flying conditions again, Teague had already got two of his planes gone. And the rest of them had all tore off. We were both out of fuel, so we head back to the carrier. And poor old Teague, he read the riot act to me, "You're stupid knucklehead." I'll never forget. Two of us against eight airplanes. Whether there was eight or seven, I'm not sure. He said there was eight. Boy, we scattered those Japs all over the sky. I'm still surprised that the CO didn't call me on the carpet, but he was glad to see the report when we finally wrote it up. I'm sure he was. But he must have thought the same thing. Two knuckleheads.
And did you guys take out all eight Japanese planes?
Well, we couldn't have gotten all of them because some of them got away.
Yeah.
Like when I was chasing that bomber, they must have had 10 or 20 machine guns on there, and it was blowing fire all from all parts. Usually when you're going in on an airplane, you always try to get underneath the tail assembly because he can shoot either way, back, left, right, but not dead center because his tail's in the way. So if you can get in that position, then pull up on the nose of your airplane, you've got him in the sights, and that's when you turn them loose. So know how many we got. They gave me credit for one Betty and one smoker. They gave credit for Teague for two smokers.
How many of those kills were you credited with in all throughout the war?
During the war, I was credited for three air kills. That doesn't count any of them that we killed. Like one time we went on Rabaul. Rabaul used to be a terrifically fighter base. So we caught the fighters there one time, still sleeping. And right away, we did to them the flight of six fighters in my section. We went in single file. And it was just like, have you seen that picture what the Japanese did to Pearl Harbor? Just one right after the other, all 50s going. That's what we did to Rabaul. That didn't count, though. I got one, the first one, that was in the air, but the rest of them were all on the ground. But, you know, it's hard for me to even believe what I'm telling you. But how could I help it? My granddaughter, "Grandpa, you ought to write about this." So I wrote whenever I could about the Guadalcanal campaign, typed it up, and I just threw it on the desk. Nobody would believe that, absolutely nobody. So I think it's still on my desk if it didn't get in the junk pile. That's all it was, nothing but a 10-cent dime novel. What can I say? I was there, I did it.
This is radio. People can't see the look in your eye or the water coming out of your eyes, and I wish they could. They'd know how real this is for you. I want to follow up with some of those stories. I know I'm bouncing around a bit, but let's start with Guadalcanal. You said you wrote about it. What are the things that you saw? You're just a young kid in the Marines fighting the Japanese. What are the things that you saw and experienced on the ground in combat that were difficult for you?
Well, on one of the trips, we finally got to the top. And, of course, then down on the other side is the Japanese control. And they would start coming back up, throwing hand grenades. All they would use would be hand grenades. They would just toss them just maybe 20 feet ahead of them. That was to get rid of us. Well, this one Japanese I spotted real early. It was big for a Japanese. And he started up the hill, and pretty soon I couldn't see him. I was dug in a foxhole, looking over the side, and I couldn't see him. And then I saw him. He got up on his knees, so I watched him. And he would come up on his hands and knees, then roll over on his back, and just toss that grenade over him. He must have did that four or five times while he was coming up that side. When he got to the top, and I was being quiet, because as soon as you fire, then the Japs know where you're coming from. So they get the small arms fire gets you. So he got pretty about maybe 20 feet away from me, and he was a little bit off to the right, my right. For some reason or other, he didn't stand up. He got up on his knees, and he was just looking around. And then I could tell he spotted me. And he had hand grenade, and he's getting ready to throw it like this. And I had to cut him down. Just like that, another human being. Another human being down the drain. Some poor mother. Yali, don't. Why can I forget that? He was so surprised. That's why I knew he saw me. And I think I saw his hand start coming up with a grenade in it. And he'd have gotten me if I hadn't. That was when we had 15 men out of 62 left on that bloody knoll. You know, and you think about that bloody knoll. Once you start up it, boy, there's no turning back. There's no turning back. There's no eating, no sleeping. And sometimes you're gone 3, 4, 5 days up there. And they couldn't bring any supplies in. They couldn't even give us any ammo up there. And that last time I went up it, they gave me 30 rounds. That's all the ammo we had. And with an 03, those 30 rounds could last 7 seconds, shooting left-handed. When you shoot left-handed, it's as close to a machine gun as you can possibly get, because all you're doing, you're holding the rifle left-handed, and all you do is reach over with your right and grab the bolt head. And with your left hand, you push the rifle over to the side, and while you're pushing it over, that ejects the spent shell. Then you put the rifle back, and that sends the bolt forward, and it increases replaces the spent shell with a live one. So all you're doing is pushing that rifle just back and forth, back and pretty soon you're out of ammo. And then the only thing you got left to fight with is a bayonet. And how can you ever carry on a fight after 3, 4 days of starving? You don't have enough strength to wet without wetting in your pants. That's how weak you are. Then you finally roll back down. And it was sure great at the end of the third trip up, the 3rd Marine Division came in and they replaced us.
You went on to fight in the air after that, but so many more Marines died on all those islands in the Pacific. How much respect do you have for those Marines who fought at Guadalcanal, at Tarawa, at Iwo Jima, at Okinawa, and Tinian and Saipan, and all those places?
Well, a lot.
Well, and after all, you were one of them initially, and I know we're bouncing around a little bit, but I get the sense that you had respect, and I know you didn't care for the enemy and what Imperial Japan had done to America, but it sounds like you had respect for some of those pilots that you went up against as well.
One pilot especially, we got into a wicked dogfight, and he was a good pilot. He was a real good pilot, I could tell, because he took me a while. But I finally got around in back of him, and the burst, I gave him a long burst, and right away it started to smoke. I got the oil cooler pretty fast. Then something blew up, and I wanted to see closer, so I pulled up on the side of him, and I gave him the bailout signal. Sure, he was my enemy, but he was a human being, and he lost the fight. The bailout signal was what they use today. It makes me laugh. That was bailout, you're on fire.
It's like a basketball coach calling timeout or something, huh?
That's what they're using today.
Yeah.
But that means bailout, you're on fire. And by then I was on his wing, and you could see blood in there on the canopy cover. He was all gone. His head was, he wasn't dead. It was like this. And I kept doing that, rocking my wings to try to catch his attention. He finally looked over. And you know what that SB did? He gave me the thumbs up signal and smiled at me. And he blew up after I did what I did. He was acknowledging defeat and he was thanking me for trying to help.
I can see how that would stick with you.
Well, and you're the dive bomber. The best way to go down on them is to try to get right above your target, then roll over on your back, then pull the nose down and go straight down and pick up all the speed you can get with the diving flaps open. But still, you can pick up some speed, because where you need it is when you come out of it, because while you're coming down, they're usually hiding behind something. And as soon as you start pulling up, you're not going to shoot them anymore. That's when the small arms fire kills you. And you very seldom ever fly your airplane in a straight line. You never fly it in a straight line, because all they know is, like, if you're a dove hunter, you don't ever shoot at a dove. You always shoot to where the dove's going to be in 5 seconds. Same as with an airplane. If you're diving, you're going straight down, but your airplane's cocked off to the side like this, they're aiming, leading you over here. Well, you're not going over there. You're going this way. Your airplane is sliding. Yeah. Those are some of the things you learn the hard way.
And I've had some guys about dive bombers. They've told me when you get to the bottom of that dive and you start to pull up, that you actually black out. And you have to stick the stick between your legs?
You do that every time.
You black out every time.
One time I got into a dogfight with a pilot. And I always like, because of that gunner I lost, to tell my man, take care of yourself. Don't worry about me. And so we got into a circle going. And I couldn't get on him, and he wasn't able to get onto me. So he finally made a mistake. And the thing is, I rolled over on my back and pulled back hard. I knew I was going to black out, but you trim your airplane for that. So as soon as you let up on the pressure on the stick, you come to. And I pulled that trick on him. And when I came to, he was right there in front of me, dead center. His belly was right there. And you can see his pieces of his airplane flying off. But it was just a matter of, that's where all the training in boot camp really paid off. You know, we always hated that, but we were tough. I mean, physically tough. And the guy that can stay blacked out, that means he doesn't have any blood up here. He's going to end up being the winner. Because if I black out, you're going to black out, because you're going to match me.
Right.
But if I can stay there a second longer, I've got you. Just that simple.
Uh-huh. It's sure. I mean, obviously, I've never done that. But it seems scary to me, and it seems like it takes a lot of faith to believe you're going to come to again, and or that you're going to come to in time.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, but that's right. You never know for sure.
Well, one thing I know for sure is that I want to hear more of Augie Palercio's story next time. We're out of time for now. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.